Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with Chris Sturgis, the founder of Learning Edge, and a deep thinker in the realm of competency or mastery-based education. The two discuss how the grade and rank system of public education harms children of all income levels by creating impossible pressures and expectations. How can public education develop ideas that, as Sturgis puts it, are inclusive and respectful of the communities they serve, while replacing the inhumane caste system with one that understands that all kids can be successful? That question and more on this episode of Podcast Ed. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Today I'm excited to have Chris Sturgis, who is one of the great thinkers in public education. Chris is writes a lot about ways to improve public education. She has an orientation towards understanding how people learn and writes a lot about aligning our public education systems to our best science of learning and motivation. I want to thank you and welcome you to our podcast.
Thank you, Doug.
You write a lot about motivation, instruction, assessment, and the kind of changes we should make. So let's start there. What kind of improvements would you like to see us make in the processes of motivating, instructing, and assessing kids?
Great question. I always go back to the research on learning because it's developed so much over the past 30 years that we can actually have a lot of confidence in having it guide us in how we design schools and classrooms and even the overall education system and policies. We're going to keep learning. I don't call it the science on learning. I think we're just going to keep learning about learning. But I've reviewed the research and it's very well developed at this point. And so the most important thing we have to remember when we think about the research on learning and what it tells us about how we should be motivating, instructing, and assessing kids is that we are not born as empty vessels, right? Our brains aren't empty vessels that teachers pour knowledge into. We actually have to have an activated mind. We have to want to learn. And that means we have to pay both attention to how do we activate it and how do we get kids to actually put that effort in to really work hard at learning. And so the schools that are modernizing are organizing using three of the sets of the research on learning. And the first is around the cognitive sciences, and that's going to tell us how we take in new information, process it, store it, and retrieve it. And the most important thing to remember about all that is that our working memories fill up. If we get too much going on in our heads, we just tune out. We've all done it at a conference, right? After about 10 minutes of talking, we're kind of listening, but we're not really remembering anymore what the speaker is saying. The second set of research is around social emotional learning. And I would say almost every school in America has been introducing social emotional learning and or the growth mindset in some way into their schools, at least into their elementary schools. And that really tells us that if kids are feeling afraid, their amygdala gets activated, they're not going to learn as much, they're not going to be able to pay attention. And if they're worrying about lots of other things going on in their life, like a virus or their parents losing their jobs, they are going to have a harder time having their working memory being directed towards those learning tasks. And the third set of research is around motivation theory. And in that sense, it really comes down to that we have a sense of purpose. We're more motivated when we have a sense of autonomy and some control over our environment. And when we're actually able to reach mastery, that we're successful in what we set out to do. And when we feel proud that we've worked hard and learned something, we get this rush of endorphins. We actually, our hormones kind of kick in. And that feels good and we want more of it. And kids are going to be, will put more effort towards learning if they know they're going to be successful. So if we design schools around the research on learning, there's going to be different set of core features than we have in our traditional schools. And we always have to start with the goal of every student being successful. Again, it's linked to motivation theory. It's also linked to equity, and it's linked to having the strongest economy we could possibly have and the strongest we could possibly have, right? And the goal of every student being successful is really how we're going to demolish the systemic racism that haunts our schools. So some of those features, we want to make sure our kids feel safe and that they belong. And it means we have to invest upfront in strong relationships. We want to coach our students in self-regulation of their emotions and of their thinking, metacognition, and how to plan, execute, and reflect on their own learning. We want them to be the strongest learners that they could possibly be. And that's really what's described when we talk about student agency. And there's a real common belief, a dangerous common belief out there right now, that choice is the same as student agency, and that will lead us down the wrong path. So student agency is a set of really highly developed complex skills and mindsets. And we want to make sure the learning targets are transparent. That gives kids some purpose, some autonomy about their learning process, and it sure helps create a learning culture of learning in the schools. We want to organize the classrooms and the learning experiences and assessments about where students are in their learning, their growth, what they're learning to do, and what they need to be successful. And we want to fill those gaps. Where kids have gaps, we need to fill them, because otherwise they're going to just trip up at the next higher level studies. And our grading and assessment system needs to be designed around the research on learning as well. And that means we're going to be communicating to students about their learning, their growth, and we're going to have more formative assessments than summative, because we want to make sure kids are getting feedback they need to learn. And when we do summative assessments, it's always used for planning for the next steps. It's not, the purpose is not just to rank and sort kids. There's a real purpose to summative that can help create the culture of learning in a school.
So, Chris, I want to dive down a little bit in terms of, as a teacher, how much choice do I give my students? And how does that relate to agency? Because that seemed like a very interesting topic that you raised. Obviously, you want the kids to have a sense of ownership. You want them to, you want to tap into their internal motivation, and that ownership, you know, relates to internal motivation. So as a teacher, what's the right balance between giving kids choice and helping build agency through choice? But I'm hearing you say that if you give them too much choice, it might undermine what you're trying to accomplish. So flesh that out for me a little bit.
One of the things that happens as we start to talk about the modern school system is we shift often to an orientation towards individualism, right? That every kid's going to be treated very differently based on what they're knowing, and it's going to be independent individual learning. That's not necessarily where we need to go. And when we talk about where they are in their learning, it's where they are in their learning in terms of building blocks of learning, of becoming developing student agency, but also where they are in terms of their academic skills and the higher order skills. Right? So it's not just the academic standards. The issue of choice, I once had someone call me and said, if choice is good, then we want more choice. How many options should I put on the playlist?
Right.
We just have to that's the wrong kind of way of thinking about it. So you have to think about the whole child and the whole classroom. And then you think about, when you think about giving kids some autonomy and control over their learning, that might be where they get to learn. When I was in New Zealand schools, I would walk in and there would be 7 or 8 different options for where kids learn. They might be tucked under a tent reading. They might be at a desk with other friends, or table with other friends. They might be outside, they might be in a small room so that they didn't have any noise distracting them. So part of that choice about where kids learn is to help kids actually understand how do you learn best, and how do you create the conditions for yourself to learn best, right? So it links back to their reflection and their ability to regulate their emotions and also be able to have some control and make good choices about their learning. But you also want to think about the individual needs, that there's also substantial research about collaborative learning as being very, very important to how kids learn, being able to think through complex learning tasks together. Because for all of us, we know anytime it gets complex, we're going to benefit by having collaborators. Right? Because people are going to bring in different issues and different perspectives, and that helps us learn.
Right. So I'm hearing you say that you've got to balance helping the child develop their individual capacities and their individual interest, but also understand that they're social creatures and you have to learn how to cooperate with other people. And that involves compromise, and that involves, you know, sometimes giving up some things that you want to do in order for the greater good. So a part of schooling then is helping kids learn how to balance those things. Am I interpreting you correctly?
Yeah, I think I often will talk about creating balanced systems.
Right.
But it's rooted not only in the system building, but also in that when we're thinking about whole child and then communities of children in the classroom, that we're thinking it's a complex starting point, and it's a changing starting point, right? Because the kids are going to keep changing.
Anybody who's ever raised children will know that it's a complex formula in terms of, you know, how much freedom you give them and how much lack of freedom that you give them, because it's an ongoing challenge as a parent, at least, to try to figure out what that balance. So I'm sure as a teacher, I had the same challenge. So I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. And elementary school teachers really understand graduated release, right? Which is, as students demonstrate different abilities, then you give them more responsibility. What happens by the time they're getting into that fifth grade and older, we're now very much into that stage of delivering a curriculum and kids all doing the same thing in the traditional system.
So that's a nice transition to my next question. You write a lot about the fact that traditional school systems mistakenly equate delivery of curriculum with learning. Can you elaborate a little bit on what you mean by that distinction between, you know, delivering curriculum versus student learning?
I think the number one mistake that schools have made as we've been making this transition to the modern school is not taking enough time to analyze the traditional system and why it was designed and what the implications are. And this is one of those characteristics of the traditional system. And you just go back and, right, it was created kind of between our school systems were developed between 1850 and about 1905. That's kind of the core set of policies. And we were empire building. We were dispossessing Native Americans. We were building towns going west rapidly. We had a flow of immigrants coming into the cities on the East Coast. And a group of people started to say, we need, you know, a school system that can be implemented. And so we created the standardized system with organizing kids by grade and delivering a curriculum for each of those grades and testing at the end and then deciding based on those tests how to sort kids. And we would rank and sort them, and then some would go to college and some would have enough skills to kind of go into the factories or trades and jobs like that. And because of the racial capitalism that the United States is based on, a whole group of those students were actually let go, or, you know, were barely taught to read, and they just really were not prepared with the same set of skills. And that is the low wage labor system that we have. And that delivery of the curriculum would be that teachers would be trained in how to deliver this curriculum, and they would deliver it. And gosh, I mean, just think about, I remember about 15 years ago, I was in New York City, and they were trying to have every teacher on the same page of the curriculum guides on the same day across the school systems, right? And a lot of districts have tried that because of high mobility. They thought that would work. There's a rational logic to it, but boy, is it extreme. They're not doing that now in New York City, but it was a while ago. And the problem is, when we make the delivery of the curriculum be what is successful for a teacher, there's absolutely no accountability in the system for actually making sure that kids are successful. Because, and we did this because there was a belief that some kids should learn, some kids could learn, and the rest really couldn't or shouldn't learn. And so it was an acceptable and, in fact, desired outcome to deliver deliver the same curriculum, but have very different outcomes of learning. I mean, the system was designed to do that. And it's really the reason we have such an unreliable and variable system, and why we've spent the last, 25, 30 years now on accountability. We've been trying to embed accountability from top down with federal and state policies, when in fact what we need to do is embed accountability into the actual design of schools And I do want to say that this system of ranking and sorting kids is being held in place by colleges, the college admissions process and the use of the GPA, which is then held in place by the U.S. News and World Report ranking colleges and universities. So there's a lot of pressure to keep this system in place.
Let's talk a little bit about how do we move from where we are to where we need to go. I mean, as you mentioned, there's a lot of cultural forces that are fiercely resistant to change. There's a lot of institutional momentum in public education. I spent 15 years as a teacher union leader, and we were well intentioned to try to protect our teachers and from a very dysfunctional system. And so we developed contracts that pretty much put in place things that were almost impossible to change. So it seems pretty daunting to sort of move towards a sort of one size fits all assembly line model to a much more flexible model that that appreciates the individual needs of each child while at the same time fostering, you know, collaboration and moving toward a much more competency-based system. What's your thinking about how to move from here to where you'd like us to go? I mean, how's that going to happen? What's that going to look like? What's your put on your idealistic hat for a minute. Let's talk about a hopeful future, about how do we begin to move from where we are to where you think we ought to go?
So ideally, what I believe, I left Competency Works about 2 years ago, but during the 10 years of Competency Works, I visited schools and talked to educators all the time. Like, that was just my job. And I got to see so much of the country and even into New Zealand. And what came to me after all of this was everybody who has any involvement with schools. So that's going to be policymakers, it's going to be school boards, it's going to be parents and teachers and kids themselves need to understand the core aspects of the research on learning.
Right.
And hold them together as a set that they work together, right? So it's, again, you don't pull out one strand and say, this is the only thing we're going to focus on. It's all of it together. But these, right. And have some agreement on that. And that begins to build the consensus. And the other place where I think, and this is a lack of imagination, I think, at this point, but that doesn't mean we can't learn and get there. We have to have ideas that are inclusive and respectful of our communities, of where they are, and then also be able to offer something different than this idea that ranking and sorting kids is acceptable. We have to be able to replace our ideas of the caste system, of hierarchy,
right,
with one that is, that can understand all kids as successful. And the difficulty, and you'll see it immediately, when you use anything about all kids as learners or everybody being successful, there's a group of people who hear that as everybody the same.
Right.
And it actually triggers parents to write, or some community members to write things about communism, which I'm like, I don't think that's really where our greatest threat is right now. But it's hard to imagine, and I get this, it's hard to imagine how do you have everybody be successful and not the same. And that is, and so I was in North Dakota as at a school, and they talked about greatness, everybody discovering their greatness. And I was another school in Milwaukee, and they talked about what does it take for every student to be successful, but it wasn't based on the timeline of the teachers, but it was really walking that path with kids to find what it means to be successful in their lives and really starting where kids were. It was more developmental than I'd seen in most schools. But being able to get our heads really rooted in that is going to be necessary. And I think the best way of doing it is just highlighting those schools that are figuring out how to do it. I think it's helpful to have community conversations, but I think the most important thing for us is to find enough examples of communities and schools figuring out what that looks like. And I think people will jump to it very quickly because it feels good to everybody. Everybody wants their child to be successful.
You know, as you were talking, I kept thinking about the definition of success in our country, which is very much money-oriented and materialistic. And I know in other countries, particularly in Europe, Scandinavia, happiness isn't necessarily measured by how much material possessions you have, but in other ways. And whenever you read about inequalities in the United States, which is a real problem, it's always defined as economic. And obviously there's a high correlation between economic security and happiness. But it'd be interesting if we began to build a system around success, but not necessarily defined purely through materialism, but success can be in all kinds of different ways, most notably a sense of contentment in happiness in life. And I wonder if a lot of this sorting that we do is so driven by our belief that economic prosperity is the only way to happiness and material possessions. And the more material stuff you assume you acquire, the more happy you are. I mean, is that part of what's going on here? Is that part of the ranking and sorting and competition for Ivy League schools? Is part of what we have to do is redefine and empower people to define happiness in ways that's more healthy, I guess?
I would even take a step further back. I mean, I think it's a really important thing to ask, what does it mean to be successful? I think that's really important. I think it's going to be multifaceted in some sense. So one I would say is that they're excellent learners, right? They know how they learn and what it takes to, that's going to be part of being successful. That they have some sense of purpose and curiosity or a vision for themselves about what they want. Because we're talking about 18-year-olds, right? The K-12 system we're talking about what that looks like at a very transitional time of kids' lives. And the transition to adulthood usually goes to about age 28, right? 25, 28. And so it's a time of transition. They're beginning that transition a little bit earlier in high school, some kids much earlier, they have to take on adult responsibilities. So we have to think about what does it mean to be successful at that point in their lives. They need to be able to have the opportunity to have some flexibility in what they pursue, because they may not know what they want to pursue career-wise. So I would take the step and try to describe what that looks like then. But the issue that you're raising about economic power, and I would say access to social capital as well, we know that inequity is growing, economic inequity is growing in America. And we know, I can't remember the name of it. Paul Tough's recent book about the college admissions process is just mind blowing, but right. About the pressure on the children of upper class to be able to maintain their position in the caste system, to maintain their position within a sort of educated elites and economic elites is horrifying. I mean, it's almost like there's a cannibalization of their own of the children, because there's so much pressure from parents that kids maintain that access to the elite colleges and what that brings to them. So I think the pressure is as hard on the upper class in terms of children's well-being. I mean, these issues about private schools having to pay attention to kids' mental health and their fear of suicide and how many ambulances come to the schools at the upper income schools. I mean, that's horrifying. Something is really wrong when that's going on. So the difficulty in the pressure around the economic orientation of our school systems, I think it's hurting everybody right now. It's hurting everybody. We are at a breaking point on this.
You know, it's interesting, Chris. I think, you know, I run the largest education choice program in the country. We've got about 150,000 kids right now in Florida alone in five different choice programs that we manage. There's a sixth program that the government manages in Florida, has another 30,000 kids in it. And over half the kids in Florida, by the way, attend a school beyond their zone neighborhood school, most of it within school district choice. But when we survey our families, it's interesting as to why families make participate in various choice programs. But the number one thing they refer to is really safety. And some of it is physical safety, but a lot of it is sort of emotional safety. And I think what parents are looking for is a safe space for their children to feel good about who they are as human beings. And in many ways, they're trying to get out of the competition that you just referred to. They're trying to get out of this sort of caste system because they intuitively know it's not safe for their children. You know, they see their children internalizing, how they're being sorted. And of course, our program primarily deals with low-income families. The average family of four makes about $27,000, $28,000 a year. So these are low-income families who oftentimes are trying to get their kids out of a situation where they're internalizing a message that says you're inferior. And so they're looking for a space. It's kind of interesting. They don't rank academics as their number one priority. What they rank as their number one priority is safety. And when you talk to them, it's very much an emotional safety where their child feels that they aren't being somehow attacked. And I really think you got your finger on it, which is these parents know that once their child gets labeled and they internalize that label, that their child's in a lot of trouble. And so it's fascinating to see that the school choice movement or education choice movement, because it's now well beyond schools, is driven by a lot of the things that you're talking about, families looking for safe space and trying to find an environment where their children aren't being labeled as failures and being put into a box that they may not be able to get out of.
Yeah. The A through F grading system, I believe now, I this is just a theory. I have no actual evidence of this, but I was able to do some work for the Mastery Transcript Consortium and talk to a lot of people about grading, and a lot of people on the higher end academically, kids, parents,
right,
and schools. And what was so interesting to me is I ended up feeling like our grading process starting in elementary school is telling kids where they belong. It's like,
right,
it's putting kids on a road so that they know where they fit into the caste system. And by the time you're done with grade 12, you're like, yeah. Okay. That's where I fit.
Right.
And in doing that, it's exactly what you're saying. It makes you also kind of know who's above you and who's below you, and you want to keep them below you. And, you know, that, and all of a sudden, like, that just creates a huge number of issues. And I always felt that the standards reference and standards based grading systems were effective because they were aligned with the research on learning. But I now think that they contribute to the kind of reinforcing the caste system in the United States, but also diminish well-being for all kids.
Yeah.
Who are getting the A's all the way down to the kids who are getting the F's.